We are celebrating two anniversaries this week. 2 nights ago, we celebrated the 60th anniversary of the first broadcast of WGN. And tonight, 2 days ahead of the actual occasion, we celebrate June 6th, the landings on D-Day at Omaha Beach by two American armies, two American divisions, I should say, one of them being the 1st Division, upon which we focus, and that is because we've got a wonderful new book available by Flint Whitlock, who's one of our guests. It's titled The Fighting First, The Untold Story of the Big Red One on D-Day. Our other guest tonight is an old friend who's been here many times before, Colonel John Votaw, U.S. Army retired, who is the executive director of the 1st Division Museum out at Cantini. John, give us a background on the division itself. It's larger history from its... It was founded originally and organized
for service in World War I.
In World War I, that's what I remember.
The 1st Expeditionary Division regiments were gathered up on the Mexican-Texas border, and General Pershing thought he was going to be the division commander, only to discover that he was the commander of the entire AEF. But they served in World War I. As you know, our battle history in World War I was rather short. We were there about 16 months total, and of that, only about 5.5 to 6 months in action.
But the first battle was taking a French town called Cantigny.
Cantigny, that's right.
Thus the colonel, McCormick, who was a veteran of that division and of World War I, named his country home Cantigny.
That's correct. He was present at the battle, commanded the 1st Battalion, 5th Field Artillery, which is still an active part of the 1st Division today. Mm-hmm. After service in World War I, there was, of course, some reorganization, thanks largely to a fellow by the name of George C. Marshall, who had been, among other things, the operations officer of the 1st Division in World War I. It served with distinction in World War II as a triangular division, as our Army infantry divisions were at the time.
What does that mean, a triangular
division? That means that one of the infantry regiments, in this case the 28th, was withdrawn. There had been four infantry regiments organized in two brigades in World War I, and the 28th was withdrawn, and it served with the 8th Division in World War II. Elements of it come back during the Vietnam War, which is the third major combat period from 1965 to 1970 in the Republic of Vietnam. And then after that, of course, they return back in 1970 and become a mechanized division. And it's from that point that they are deployed in 1990 to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and serve in that war, and Lieutenant General Tom Rame, retired, who commanded the division in that war, is now the president of our Veterans Society.
And they served as well in the Balkans, didn't they?
Yes, indeed.
In fact, our good friend, General David Grange,
yes,
now of the Tribune Foundation,
right,
or the McCormick Foundation here in this building, was the commanding general when they were in Kosovo.
That's correct. And if you remember, also in Macedonia, that the division had deployed from Germany into that region, and General Grange was the division commander at that time.
And they're now in Iraq again, are they not?
Yes, that's right. They were deployed to Germany, first to Würzburg, and now they're over there in Iraq.
Yeah. Now, if we come to their World War II service, it doesn't begin at Omaha Beach. It begins in North Africa.
That's right. They were employed in November of 42 to be one of the divisions that landed on the coast of North Africa, and they had about a six-month campaign there.
They went through the bloody Kasserine Pass battle, didn't
they? That's right. And one of the problems was that the division was kind of broken up. Terry Allen was the commanding general at that time. Teddy Roosevelt Jr. was the assistant division commander. But they weren't actually in command of their troops, because the various units were parceled out to the British. And Terry Allen was quite upset about that, and he went to Eisenhower to complain, and because the British had very low regard for American fighting mm-hmm. men at that point, and consequently they did not perform as well as Allen thought they could.
Were they loaned out to Montgomery? Was it Augenfleck? Which British
Kenneth Anderson.
Anderson,
right. Down in the middle, yeah.
Yeah, and so finally they allowed Allen to reconstitute and rejoin his force, and then they made a very good account of themselves. Patton wrote several letters back praising the performance of the division. Eisenhower was kept abreast of how well the division was doing. And after the 6-month campaign in North Africa, the veterans were they were ready to go home. They said, you know, we've done our part. let's go back to the States, and we'll become a training outfit for the new divisions that are being formed. But the Army had had more plans for them.
And Patton wanted them to come along to Sicily.
That's right. That's right. He said
he had
that
been assigned another division, which was not to his liking, and
yeah,
he said, I must have the 1st Division.
Hmm.
That's right. And
by then, they really had the reputation of being the most battle-experienced.
There's only one way to get combat experience, and that's to be in combat.
Yeah.
And you either learn from that experience, or you die, or other bad things happen.
So they did the Sicily campaign.
They did the Sicily campaign. Eisenhower had seen that Terry Allen was fairly well burned out. He was
mm-hmm.
exhausted. Allen was the kind of general that the troops really liked. He reputedly was the only general who slept on the ground, as opposed to a cot or a tent, a nice cushy bed in some rear area house. He shared the dangers with his men, and I think that took a toll on him. He was relieved after the Battle of Troina in Sicily.
They bring in a fellow named Huebner, isn't it? How do you say his
Clarence
name?
Huebner.
Huebner. Huebner.
Mm-hmm. And Huebner had been with the division in World War I, and he had started out as a private. Even before the war, mm-hmm. he had joined before World War I began. And he worked his way up through the ranks. I believe he was a battalion commander in World War
I. He actually started World War I as a company commander. His yeah. battalion commander was mortally wounded, and then he finally acceded to the command of his regiment.
Now, after Sicily, they really think they're going back to the States.
Well, they were hoping.
Yeah. But they wound up in England.
That's right.
And quickly they're put into training for the great cross-channel invasion.
Mm-hmm. They were sent to training camps in southern England along the coast there, and had about 6 months of training, doing all the stuff they'd already done. But they had also received a number of replacements.
Yeah.
They had taken heavy casualties in North Africa and Sicily, and so they had to bring in some new guys.
Now we arrive at the day, Der Tag, as the Germans would have said, namely June 6th, which is only 2 days away from right now,
right.
but 60 years, over 80 years later. What am I saying? 60 years later.
60
years later. We celebrated the 80th anniversary of WGN, and we're celebrating
right.
the 60th of D-Day. Hope I had that right the first time around. John, give us the general background on this. What was the scope, what was the challenge of the invasion of France?
Well, General Eisenhower's difficulty was, I think, twofold and importantly so. One is to establish the high command structure so that it would be fully integrated in the coalition concept where all members of the Allies were contributing to the central goal of accomplishing his mission, which was to re-enter the continent of Europe and engage and defeat the German armed forces. And in that regard, he had established Sir Frederick Morgan, a British officer, lieutenant general, as Cossack, chief of staff to the Supreme Allied Commander, right after the Casablanca Conference in 1943. And so they had been planning, and along with this went Bolero, which was the logistic and administrative build-up in Great Britain. I always like to call it the largest aircraft carrier in the world, with all of the materiel of war that's being assembled mm-hmm. there for the great push. The other part of this is selecting the units. And in the early planning for the cross-channel invasion, they were under-planning. They were thinking in terms of 3 divisions, which Montgomery rightly argued was certainly not enough. And, of course, then that was plussed up to 5 assaulting divisions and then with a number of backup divisions in the second line ready to go.
So how many men does that mean?
Well, I think on D-Day the number varies from about 156,000 assaulting troops at the low end and about 174,000.
The last time there was a cross-channel invasion came from the other direction, from Normandy over to England. With 5,000 men.
Yes.
And they conquered England.
Different circumstances.
William the Conqueror.
Battle of Hastings, right.
The Battle of Hastings.
Yes, there was no German army waiting for them at that time.
To be sure. Was there some sense that with all of that planning, with all of that commitment of material and a vast force of men, that they might not succeed?
Oh, yes. No, airborne operations and assault from the sea are among the two chanciest military operations that you can conduct.
And costliest in terms of the death of soldiers.
Well, yes and no. Again, it depends on the quality of the planning, the quality of the training. There was great effort made, of course, to train these troops to a fine edge. The 29th Division, which had remained in England when the first sailed to North Africa to continue to train, had not been in combat yet, but they had undergone a great deal of rigorous training.
We've got some sound clips we're going to be playing as we go tonight. And the first one is the announcement by General Eisenhower that the invasion is on, his D-Day radio address.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Boy, that's a thrilling and chilling thing to hear, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. You wonder what effect it had on the soldiers who were, you know, thinking about their own fate and realizing that they were a part of something so monumental that they probably didn't grasp the true meaning of it at that time.
Now, the invasion was along about 90 miles, or is it more than that, of Normandy coast?
It's about 61 miles from one end to the other.
And Omaha Beach is only about...
It's only about 5 miles.
Five miles. Mm-hmm. But that was the basic target for the 1st Division.
That's right. That's right.
And it was supposed to be the most difficult of all of the landings. Why?
Well, the Germans under Rommel, who was the head of Army Group B and had the responsibility for fortifying the coasts and possible landing areas, obviously the Germans did not know where or when the Allies were going to land, so they had to do the impossible, which was try and defend everywhere. It just happened that Omaha Beach was the furthest spot from the southern coast of England. And they thought, well, the Allies probably won't land there. They'll probably cross the Pas de Calais and land at Calais. And that's where they put the bulk of their heavy weapons, their concrete fortifications, their panzer divisions.
With a fair amount of deceptive operations by the Allied
that's
forces
right.
to persuade them we were going to
right,
the
Operation
Pas de Calais.
Fortitude was the deception plan. But they couldn't discount Omaha Beach as a possible landing site, too, because the beaches were flat. There's an area there, the five-mile span, where there are no cliffs that have to be climbed by any attackers. And so I think in the back of Rommel's mind, he said, this could happen here. So he made a special effort to beef up that area as well, and so had a number of fortifications there, machine guns and anti-tank weapons that, instead of firing out to the ocean, fired parallel to the beach, so that if any troops or vehicles got through the outer crust of the beachhead, they'd be caught in this crossfire.
In the very introduction to this fine book that you've done, Flint Whitlock, the title being The Fighting First, The Untold Story of the Big Red One on D-Day, In the very introduction, you've got a wonderful evocation of what it would have been like for an ordinary soldier in a landing craft as they went in for that particular assault. We've got some commercials that are overdue. Let's take care of those, and then I want you to read that long passage so we can really get a sense of the human situation, of the human challenge for these 18 to 20-year-old kids who are there to destroy the Wehrmacht of the Nazi Reich. We return directly to Flint Whitlock and John Votaw after these words. And we return to Colonel John Votaw, who in his time has served in the 1st Division, of course, and is executive director of the 1st Division Museum at Cantini, and Flint Whitlock, military historian, regular contributor to World War II magazine, to World War II History magazine, author of a number of military histories. The newest one is titled The Fighting First, the story of the Big Red One on D-Day. Westview Press are the publishers. Take us into the beach.
Well, what I wanted to do in the introduction was to put the reader in the shoes of the young man who was about to assault the shore. They were in their landing craft for several hours after they got it out of the transports, crawled down the scramble nets into the small LCVPs, as they were called, Higgins boats, and then were told to circle until it was time for them to hit the beach. And many of them were very seasick because of the rough ocean and scared. They heard the shells flying over from the big Navy guns. And in the introduction I write, "Gripping your M1 Garand rifle so tightly that you think you will leave the impression of your hands forever embossed into the wooden stock, you hear and feel the boat grind into the sand and come to a jolting stop that throws you and everyone in the boat forward. You then watch with unspeakable horror as the ramp begins to slowly and agonizingly descend, a curtain revealing a frightful technicolor movie full of smoke and fire and ear-ripping explosions that confirm all of your earlier fears. As the noise reaches a crescendo and the ramp drops further, all you hear are prayers murmured by men both pious and agnostic, and your lips join in reciting the familiar litany, Hail Mary, full of grace, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our deaths. Or Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Or though I walk through the shadow of the valley of death, I shall fear no evil. Or Shema Yisrael, Adonai Elohanu, Adonai Had. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You see men touching their St. Christopher medals and fingering their rosaries and making the sign of the cross. Suddenly the men in front of you are swept forward and you are caught up in a human tide that can only go in one direction. You watch in dumb horror as your officer and non-commissioned officers collapse in an olive drab blood-stained heap as the falling shield exposes them to the enemy's fire. You somehow find the courage to step over them and carry on. With your buddies all around you, as frightened as you are, you give one long terrifying shriek, as much to build up your courage as to act as a relief valve for all the pent-up terror. Now you are out of the protective shell of the landing craft and into a world the reality of which exceeds your imagination a million-fold and for which months of intensive training have left you unprepared. Your feet slip on the wet ramp, now underwater. Now you too are underwater, up to your waist or neck in water so cold it numbs everything except the adrenal gland that is still pumping furiously away inside you. A frigid wave splashes you, and you taste salt and oil and blood. If you dare to tear your eyes away from the beach ahead, you notice your fellow amphibians trudging as if in the same type of slow motion found only in bad dreams, toward dry land, pushing through the flotsam of war, pieces of equipment and pieces of men. Geysers of water spring up around you as bullets and shrapnel tear into the surf, and the beach erupts in great volcanoes of sand and fire. You see no enemy at which to shoot, but their unseen presence is felt everywhere. You hear men, most of them boys like you, moaning and screaming in mortal pain and crying out for medics and their mothers. You try to hunker down as the water becomes shallower, an almost impossible task, so that only your head is a target. Your youthful belief in your own invincibility has been obliterated, and you fear you are about to be obliterated too, and very soon. You attempt to move quickly, but you're weighted down by all your equipment and sodden clothing and the immovability of trapped water molecules. Up ahead, looming above you through the smoke and low clouds is your objective, the top of the bluffs overlooking the beach. It might as well be Mount Everest, for between you and the top are profuse minefields, mortar and artillery concentrations, thickets of barbed wire, and thousands of men waiting to kill you. You know you will never make it. You, a 1st Infantry Division soldier, waterlogged, stupefied by the crashing spectacle all around you, and frightened beyond all measure, are now on the sand and trying to run the last few yards across a corpse-strewn beach to what you hope is a place of shelter and safety. But there is no shelter or safety, for you have just arrived in hell.
What a passage.
Pretty powerful. I've interviewed a number of 1st Division veterans. I remember clearly Eddie Ireland, who was a member of the 745th Tank Battalion, one of the supporting tank battalions for the 1st. And he said that when he came off in his tank, that he saw the casualties, the dead of the first waves, laid out like cordwood ahead of him. And he had this overwhelming feeling of revulsion because he didn't want to run over them with his tank. And he was preoccupied with just seeing the results of the first wave and not knowing exactly what to do about it.
I want to play another clip for you. Steve Ambrose, as you know, collected a lot of oral interviews with veterans of D-Day. He organized that D-Day museum down in New Orleans. And Douglas Brinkley and Roger Drez did a book just quite recently titled Voices of Valor. And they have associated with it two CDs that they put out, which contain some of those interviews. Here's a veteran, I don't know the name, talking about that same business, about jumping into the water approaching Omaha Beach.
Many landing vessels dropped their charges a fair distance from shore because of sandbars that prevented passage further in. Warren Brenneman with the 149th Engineer Combat Battalion landed chest deep in the water with a full load of gear.
The next 15 or 20 minutes, as I recall them, probably represented a period of time when I worked harder than at any other time I've ever worked in my life. The English Channel is very cold at this time of the year. It was very choppy, and all of us were carrying a great deal of material. As a squad leader, and I always laughed when I thought of rank having its privilege, I probably was carrying about as little as anyone in my squad, and that included my gas impermeable clothing, my rifle, my knapsack, helmet, canteen, a couple of canisters of machine gun ammunition, plus a rifle grenade launcher. Most of the men in my squad were much more heavily laden than was I.
And you worked your way to shore.
That's right. And so many of the men who were dropped off in deep water, some of whom were wounded and were having trouble staying up, drowned as a result of all of the equipment that they were carrying.
One remembers that great line from Patton. I presume, I hope that General Patton really said it. It's in the film, certainly. When he gives that speech and he says, your job, he says to all these seven soldiers, is to kill the bastard who's trying to kill you.
That's right. No dumb bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. They won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country.
What were the casualties on Omaha Beach for the 1st Division?
Well, we have a lot of differing figures, and I think John probably has the most current.
We think for the 1st Division, the best numbers we have came from the 5th Corps reporting and are the result of rolling it up and accounting for the medical situation that wasn't known at the time, who was wounded, who was missing, and so forth. But in the division, there were 1,240 total casualties, and of this, 186 officers and men killed, the remainder being wounded or missing or otherwise unaccounted for. But that's only one of the many divisions that are involved, albeit at the hottest place on the firing line.
Do I understand those numbers correctly? Yep. Killed in action?
186.
Only 186.
That's correct. See, it is an astonishing figure. If you happen to be one of those 186, of course, it's a great catastrophe.
Sure.
But nonetheless, the general tendency is to take the word casualties to mean killed.
It
means all categories of.
What was the total Allied loss on that day?
With the British and the Canadians?
Yeah, with everybody.
Well, I don't have an exact number, but we think somewhere in the neighborhood of 9,000 to 12,000 is roughly the range of the numbers.
Out of an invasion force of what size?
Of about
150,000.
156 to 174,000, depending on how you tally up the Navy and the Air Corps folks.
But of course, that's the one day.
That's one day.
A lot more death to come.
And the campaign actually goes until well into July,
yeah.
And so the figures are counted differently.
Overdue again for some commercials. We'll pause for those, then directly back to John Votaw and Flint Whitlock. We are going through D-Day with the men of the 1st Division. The text in hand, and it's a wonderful book by Flint Whitlock, one of our guests, is The Fighting First, the untold story of the Big Red One on D-Day. That's published by Westview Press. And our other guest is Colonel John Votaw, who is executive director of the museum dedicated to the 1st Division, the 1st Division Museum at Cantini. And that's out in Wheaton.
It is, yes.
That's the township.
On Colonel McCormick's estate.
Yeah. Well, so we got him on the beach. What do you do now?
Well, it was very difficult because all of the plans that had been laid on, all of the training, the millions of dollars that had been spent on specialized equipment just totally failed. The underwater demolition teams that were supposed to come in early and blow up the underwater obstacles and disarm the mines and other devices there that were meant to stop the invasion lost their equipment or just didn't make it into the right beach. There was a strong riptide in that part of the English Channel, and most of the small LCVP landing craft were pulled thousands of miles away from the beaches that the men thought they were going to land at which they had rehearsed, they had memorized the landscape and the landmarks, and by the time they started heading for the beach, nothing looked familiar to them. The Air Force, which was supposed to have softened up the German positions and bombed the casemates and the machine gun positions and provided some bomb craters on the beach for the infantry to take cover in, had totally overshot the target, killed a lot of cows in the hinterland, but did not take out any of the German positions.
This is the sort of thing that von Clausewitz has in mind when he characterizes the battlefield scene always as pervaded by the fog of war.
Yes, very much so, and it was a literal fog of war, too, because when the Navy ships, the battleships, the cruisers, the destroyers, tried to get a bead on their targets on shore, they were shrouded by clouds and mist, and so they couldn't really see, and to be safe, they didn't want to hit the men in the landing craft, and so they overshot their target.
Here's another clip from the interviews conducted by the people who were working for the museum down there in New Orleans. And this is this concerns being on the beach and what the hell you do now.
The invading forces struggled out of the water and then up the beaches toward their objectives. Warren Brenneman.
Our objective, as we understood it, was to help in the demolition of some of the beach obstacles, the logs, the tetrahedrons that the Germans had placed to keep landing craft as far from the dune line as possible. Also, we were to help in the clearing of the beach exits so that tanks and armored cars and trucks could eventually go up and get onto the level ground above the beaches, and then also to cooperate with the infantry, in this case the 29th Division, in establishing a defense perimeter around the beach. During this time, we would simply run a few yards and fall down, sometimes behind some of the beach obstacles, then make another dash for another 15 or 20 yards, drop again until we finally got to the dune line. During this time, we could hear I can still plainly remember hearing the zing, ping, ping of bullets flashing by. Not that any of us were heroes or anything of the like, but as I recall, things were happening so fast and we were so caught up in the events of the time and so tired trying to get out of the surf that we really didn't have the time to be literally frightened at this time. There were other times when we were very frightened, but fear is a rather strange emotion. There were times when you had very little reason to be frightened, and you would find yourself scared, literally scared to death. while at other times when there was some real reason to be frightened, the press of events simply prevented you from thinking about it too much.
Al Litke, with the 299th Engineer Combat Battalion, made the beach and went looking for mines.
Once I hit the beach, I went up about maybe 10, 15 feet. I laid down and I looked to my left and right, and to my left I could see about just a couple other GIs advancing. Then, getting up again, I sort of try to run. I drop my charges at the steel obstacle and then continued up to the break wall, or it was like an embankment of stones. It was like a 45-degree angle, and maybe about 6 feet high. Well, anyhow, there was plenty of room to lay down behind it, and it was well protected.
John, have you been shot at in your long Army career?
Oh, yes.
Where?
Vietnam.
In Vietnam, of course. You were not in the D-Day landings.
No, I'm not quite that old. I was alive in 1939, but yeah. Not old enough to be a soldier then.
Does that... perfectly naive and direct about it, but picking up on one of those veterans said, right. What does it feel like to be shot at?
Well, I mean, I think everything that was said there, I mean, the generally speaking, depending on how busy you are and how preoccupied you are with your mission, you may not even be giving much thought about your mortality at all.
Mm-hmm.
You're more worried about not being able to get your job done. The overwhelming things that I remember, of course, are the huge cacophonous sounds on the battlefield. Vietnam, World War II, where you have all this ammunition going off, all these weapons firing, it's virtually impossible to communicate with anybody except with hand and arm signals and pyrotechnics and some of the most primitive things that have been, you know, part of armies for many centuries. It is that, of course, when the battle lulls down or dies out or you're over with the particular action, then you have some time to think about what was going on. That's when you really get a little shaky.
That's what one of those fellows just said.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. There's a sense, I was in Vietnam also, got there just before the Tet Offensive of 68, mm-hmm. and there was a concerted Viet Cong attack on the replacement depot where I was, hugging the floor and hoping that the mattress over me would would provide protection. But there's a sense that everybody is shooting at you. You are the lone target. I don't care how many people are there, that you're the one that they're aiming for. And it's a very strange and frightening feeling. But as John said, if you have a job to do, you're manning a gun or you're trying to direct your men, you're more focused on that than your own safety.
There's another important thing here that we haven't mentioned yet, and that's supporting fires. Talking about artillery and mortars and, to a lesser degree, machine guns that help the infantry break through and get their job done. Because of the way in which the battle unfolded on Omaha Beach, you don't get your field artillery units in right away. They come in later, and of course the tanks, the swimming tanks from the 741st Tank Battalion supporting the 16th Regiment on the left, and the 743rd Tank Battalion, both of those being similarly organized with two of their companies, DD tanks, and one of the company traditionally configured, a couple of the tanks having dozer blades to help clear away obstacles on the beach. The tanks...
The swimming tanks didn't know how to swim, did they?
Only in the 741st. They were swamped. They didn't make it in. But in the 743rd to the right, with the 116th Infantry Regiment, they decided to land them on the beach rather than swim them in.
Uh-huh.
And the ones that tried to swim in were lost, all but about three didn't make it to the beach. So you not only don't have your artillery right away, you don't have your supporting tank fires right away. And this, of course, is when the destroyer flotilla that is operating offshore comes to the rescue and provides close support.
Now, right there on Omaha Beach, what's beyond the beach? There is a rise, and what's on top of the rise?
Well, the small farms, some small villages, hedgerow country, and a lot of Germans dug in.
And what sorts of emplacements?
Well, primarily their emplacements were on the slope below the bluff, below the top of the bluff.
You didn't have the heavy...
Well, you do further back. You have the heavy guns that are firing, the 150, 152 millimeter guns similar to the ones that were emplacements on Point de Hoc, but were moved out of the area in the days before the invasion.
Are they in fortified positions?
The ones at Point de Hoc were not. They were moved about 300 yards to the rear and were in a field. Mm-hmm. They were camouflaged, but they were not particularly dug in.
And are they on cliffs? Is that where you really had cliffs that men had to climb?
No.
At Point de Hoc.
Well, at Point
yes.
de Hoc it was, but not at Omaha Beach.
At
it was
Omaha
more
Beach
of a gentle slope, slope that got progressively
steeper.
Well,
actually, there were pathways, goat paths, and so forth that would find you could find your way to the top once you got through the minefields and the barbed wire with the Germans shooting at you.
Yeah.
It was about 160 feet high, maybe 200 feet high in some places, but could be scaled. And by noon, several companies, elements of E Company, the 2nd of the 16th, and G Company under Captain Joe Dawson, did make their way to the top and continued with their mission.
What do we see in the film Saving Private Ryan on the invasion? Is that 1st Division or is that supposed to be some other division?
Those are the a couple of Ranger battalions that are assaulting the beach.
Ranger battalions associated with the 1st Division?
They're attached to the assault. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's
but they were further to the west.
Is that the Omaha Beach landing represented there, or is
it's part of it? It's on the extreme right as you look at it from the sea.
Because there we have fortifications directly above on the slope.
Oh, indeed, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have a combination of mortar pits mm-hmm. that the Germans have developed, and things called Widerstandsnesten, which are in Tobruk-like, or these are concrete-lined pits. With supporting underground cover for the crews when they're not manning the guns, and when they come to action, they come up out of the shelters into the gun positions and man them.
Well, how long does it take, and how is it in fact accomplished getting up to where the first line of Germans is and wiping them out or pushing them back?
Well, the first wave landed at about 06:30 hours that morning, and John and I were talking earlier about the fact that somewhere between 11:30. And approximately 1 p.m., the 1st Division forces, most of them were making their good progress towards the top. They were either at the top or close to it. There, if I might, I'd like to read one passage from the fighting first that kind of sums up what was happening there. This was after the Navy destroyers moved in close and began firing point-blank at the German positions. German pillboxes and trenches were being swept away by the hot breath of the Navy's guns. The pinned-down American infantrymen were pinned down no longer. As German fire slackened, the Yanks crawled through the barbed wire and minefields like an inexorable olive-drab swarm of hangry, heavily armed insects bent on overcoming all obstacles in their path. So that The men were very angry that the Germans had them pinned to the beach for
so
long.
As they crawl through those minefields, some of them would get blown up, don't they?
They did. And as some of the soldiers I interviewed said to me, that the bodies of those who were killed by the mines marked the safe path to take. And those who deviated from it risked being killed or seriously wounded.
Are there heavy German losses on that first day?
Oh, yes.
I'm trying to think of the German casualties. I've seen some numbers. Cornelius Ryan says, quoting German officers that had been captured during the assault, Ryan says he was given estimates ranging from 4,000 to 9,000 total casualties by the Germans that were in the area. By the end of June, he said Rommel was to report that his casualties for the month of June were 28 generals, 354 commanders, and approximately 250,000 men as being lost in action over the period of a month.
Lost in action in the sense
of... Yeah, not all killed, but
killed and wounded again.
Killed, wounded, missing, captured.
Yeah. There is another point, too, that played against the 1st Division when they landed, that there was a battle-hardened infantry division, the 352nd, that had recently taken up positions at Omaha Beach, and the Allies didn't know about that. I mean, they went in thinking that these were just static troops, kind of low-grade guys who had come from the Russian front. Maybe they were wounded and only capable of holding a rifle and not much more. And they found out to their detriment that there were 10,000 more Germans there than they had expected initially.
Who's up against them in terms of command? What do we know about the command on the German side? Because Rommel is in charge of the overall army.
Well, no, actually, Rundstedt is the...
Rommel's been withdrawn already.
No, Rommel is there. I mean, he's absent from the battlefield on 6 June because he's gone home to observe his wife's birthday, which is the 6th of June. But more importantly, he wants to have an appointment with Hitler to argue about the control of the armored divisions, the panzer divisions, which he feels are critical. The basic dispute is between Gerd von Rundstedt, who is his superior, and Rommel, each of whom had a different concept on how to fight the battle. Rommel, because of Allied air power being so powerful, understood that we would have to meet the Allies at the waterline and defeat them there, because if we depended on moving large formations of reinforcements and counterattacking troops, they'd never survive under Allied air power. Von Rundstedt was more of a traditional thinker in that regard and favored holding back large formations to counterstrike once the penetration.
And by that time, June 1944, the Luftwaffe has been largely knocked out,
largely swept from the skies, at least in that region, not everywhere.
And the Panzer divisions also could not be released for combat without Hitler's personal approval. And the story goes that Hitler was sleeping late that morning, and everybody was afraid to wake him to tell him that the Allies were landing. And so several crucial hours passed before Hitler finally decided to release the panzers and have them move towards the beachhead. And when they did, they were turned into scrap iron because the air superiority that the Allies had just beat the hell out of them.
I had occasion last night, as we were talking about the Napoleonic Wars and what followed, to quote Wellington's famous comment about the Battle of Waterloo, where he says it was a damn close-run thing, meaning we could have lost. Was that battle, the battle on D-Day, a damn close-run thing?
Very, very much so. In fact, at one point, after several hours on the beach and no progress being reported back to General Bradley, First Army Commander, he seriously entertained the idea of withdrawing the force. That would have been an even bloodier affair had they tried to bring in landing craft and get these guys on and pull them off.
I think his first impulse, though, was to send the reinforcing units that were arriving in the battle area to the less challenged beaches. That was going to be his first decision point.
We are due for some commercials once again, and after that, we want to take the first through the rest of the European war.
Okay.
D-Day doesn't last more than 24 hours, but the division goes on from D-Day and is in the middle of it all until essentially victory.
That's right.
VE Day. We return directly to Flint Whitlock and Colonel John Vochaw after this. And we return, in turn, to Flint Whitlock and Colonel John Vochaw. The occasion for our getting together tonight is, of course, the commemoration of the 60th anniversary of D-Day, and we're doing a particular focus on the 1st Division during that famous day. And the occasion for that, or the reason for that, is we have in hand a fine new book by Flint Whitlock titled The Fighting First, The Untold Story of the Big Red One on D-Day. Some people listening might be a little bit confused or at least not clear as to why the 1st Division is called the Big Red One.
Well,
it's a direct description, isn't it?
Of course. It's their shoulder patch insignia, which is a red numeral one and an OD shield.
I would guess that's really the best-known American Army division to this day, isn't it?
Yes, I think they had a reputation of being the most experienced, the most highly trained, the most well-led. And it's funny, when you give a unit elite status, the members of that unit tend to hold themselves with a little more pride and dignity, and see themselves as role models. As one of the soldiers I interviewed said that all they had to do was look down and at their patch, and they saw that they were number one, and so they had to live up to that designation.
Now, what do they do beyond D-Day?
Well, D-Day, you know, a lot of people think, well, the war ended on June the 6th or June the 7th.
The European war was just beginning.
Yeah,
well, the Italian campaign had been done.
That's right.
The invasion of Germany was required.
That's right. So after June the 6th, it was a matter of slogging across France into Belgium and trying to break into Germany. And the closer the fighting got to the German border, the harder the Germans fought. They were defending their homeland, the fatherland. And the first had a difficult time in Operation Cobra, which was the breakout from the beachhead. But they managed to do it. And by the fall of 1944, they were on the outskirts of Aachen, which was probably the largest major German town on the German-Belgian border. And they went through
in a month
in
the southwest, really just... Yeah, just over the border.
Yeah, and
they, once the capital of Frederick the Great.
That's right, Charlemagne, I believe, had his throne there.
Yeah.
So it was a place of significance for the Germans because of its long history, being associated with the First Reich.
I said Frederick the Great. I should have said Karl the Great. Right. It's Karl der Große, which is the German of Charlemagne.
Right, and. Yeah. So even though it didn't have any strategic or tactical value, it was still a symbolic place that the Germans wanted to hold on to. And so it took the 1st Division and other supporting units and other divisions attacking it a solid month, to finally overcome the resistance in the town.
Again, with what sorts of losses?
Well, rather heavy.
Everybody's looking at me for numbers tonight.
You've got the big book there.
Yeah, I got the big book, but I don't have an accurate set of numbers. I will say that the fighting in cities does tend to produce rather higher casualties.
Yeah.
And both the Germans, who ultimately surrendered the city of Aachen, and the Americans took substantial casualties. I know in the 16th and the 26th Regiments of the 1st Division, that they had substantial casualties.
Is the first drawn into the Battle of the Bulge, the last great military gasp?
Yes.
But before
of
then,
the Reich?
After the Battle for Aachen, there was the Battle for the Hürtgen Forest.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the
also
veterans...
Also pretty bloody mess, right. That one.
Well, a lot of the veterans I talked to said it was worse than D-Day. It was worse than Omaha Beach.
Really?
For one reason was the fact that it was bone-chilling cold. These guys were out in the elements. They were fighting tanks with rifles. The Germans were throwing everything they had at them. And then in December of 44, 16th December, as a matter of fact, that's when the Germans launched their what was called Wacht on Rhein, which is the Watch on the Rhine, their code name for what we call the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah.
They were trying to punch through the Allied lines, inflict a lot of casualties, and hopefully cause the British and American public to say enough is enough, let's negotiate a peace with Hitler, let's end this.
One would say.
Yeah, that's right. But it kind of reminds me of the Tet Offensive that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong had surprised the Americans and South Vietnamese to the extent that the American public rose up and said no more, even though it was a tactical victory for the Americans.
We should not forget, as some accuse Professor Ambrose of forgetting, that the Russians, of course, are inflicting enormous casualties on the Germans on the other front, which has, of course, its consequences on the Western Front as well. We have not only General Montgomery's army and the American forces that are closing in from the Normandy beachheads and sweeping across France towards the Rhine River. We have General Devers coming up from the south as well.
Well, John, wouldn't you agree that if you really want to do alternative histories, and if Hitler had not been so stupid as to invade the Soviet Union, had never broken the Hitler-Stalin pact, wouldn't you agree that but the war was already on, because the war started in 39 and he didn't invade the Soviet Union until, I guess, it's June of 41.
Mm-hmm.
If he had not done that, this invasion by Allied forces across the channel, couldn't that never have been accomplished?
Well, we're presuming a rationality on an essentially irrational strategic planner. He had other...
But with all the two-thirds of their force was over there on the Eastern Front, was it?
Yes, of course. And there are advantages to fighting from a central position, but they're not all advantages. And, of course, when you're surrounded, then you incur other mm-hmm. difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
Could the Germans have won? Of course. There were a number of places through the war had things gone exactly right. This was not a slam dunk for sure thing. Even after the Normandy invasion, although the Allied strength and combat power was coming up at the time that the German combat power was waning. So it was a question of time if you're fighting an attrition warfare.
The overall cost in American lives, American only, was about 400,000, as I remember.
In World War II, both theaters, the European and Pacific theaters.
What did our allies pay in terms of lives lost?
Oh, goodness, certainly many times more than that. And when you think about the Russians particularly, and now we're talking only about military casualties, you know.
Yeah.
When you add in civilian casualties, it gets considerably larger. I've seen numbers as high as 60 million in all theaters when you include all civilian losses in there as well. It's an enormous catastrophe.
The Soviets lost approximately 20 million military and civilian, and that was killed. That wasn't just wounded. So we have to say that they took the brunt of the German assault, and had they not been able to hold out for the length of time that they did, who knows, you know, what would have happened. I think it's a fair chance that England would have fallen, and if that would have happened, where would we have launched our invasion? It would have been very difficult to bring all these troops across the Atlantic.
We are, of course, left to imagine what would the Allies have done had the invasion at Normandy failed. Of course, Eisenhower had a little note in his pocket, and he was prepared to accept full responsibility for the failure of the invasion had it happened. But the fact remains is, you know, and it's not totally counterfactual history to think about these things, what would have been the options that were that would have been available to the Allies?
But it did not fail.
Indeed not.
And what was the last phase of the war like for the first, for the Big Red One? After the Bulge, do they just roll forward quickly to the Elbe?
Well, they actually have to, when they come out of the Hürtgen Forest, they fight through the Ruhr River area. They have to make major river crossings as they approach Bonn, which is the next major large city that they deal with. Mm-hmm. And then they, of course, come across at the Remagen Bridge site and begin to flow in March of 45 across the river. When you think about it, from June 6, 1944 until March of 1945, the distance that they traveled to the other side of the Rhine River is about equal to the remaining distance that they travel through Germany and into Czechoslovakia by the time that 8 May 45 rolls around, and they do it in half the time.
8 May 45 is what occasion?
Victory in Europe Day.
Victory, that's VE Day.
Actually, on the 7th of May is when the Germans offer the surrender. They attempt to negotiate. Of course, Eisenhower is having none of that. His headquarters is in Reims at that time.
Well, I've got a clip here of Edward R. Murrow broadcasting the German surrender, and the date I'm given is May 4, 1945. Let's hear it. It's clip 12 on the list that we've got, and it will be coming right up.
This is London. About 6 hours ago, in a weather-stained tent not far from Hamburg, Field Marshal Sir Bernard Montgomery accepted the surrender of more than a million German troops. All of the enemy forces in northwest Germany, Holland, and Denmark have surrendered unconditionally. The ceasefire becomes effective 1 minute before 8 o'clock tomorrow, Saturday, about 7 hours from now. A few hours ago, my colleague Bill Downs told how the German officers, headed by General Admiral von Friedberg, arrived at Montgomery's headquarters. Downs reported that Montgomery addressed them as though they were vacuum cleaner salesmen, as he put to them the simple question, "What do you want?" The Germans replied that they desired to surrender three armies. Montgomery told them that those three armies were engaged against the Russians, and he declined to accept their surrender. The Germans proposed a complicated procedure covering several weeks, during which Montgomery's forces were to advance slowly while the Germans fell back rapidly. The British field marshal declined this suggestion and said that he was willing to accept the unconditional surrender of the German forces on his western and northern flanks. And so this afternoon, Montgomery walked through the rain down the graveled path to his tent to sign the paper. He said in an aside to the reporters, "This is the moment." It was the end of 30 months of battle that began at El Alamein. The documents lay on an ordinary table covered with army blankets. Here is a recording of part of Field Marshal Montgomery's remarks.
We assembled here today to accept the surrender terms which have been made with the delegation from the German army. I will now read out the terms of their instrument of surrender. The German command agrees to the surrender of all German armed forces in Holland, in northwest Germany,
including the Frisian Islands and Heligoland and all other islands.
Fascinating.
One almost gets the impression that Bernard Law Montgomery and not Dwight David Eisenhower was the commander-in-chief.
Well, we had a number of surrenders, obviously, of different German armies.
That's true. There's a wonderful story here in the Fighting First from a 1st Division soldier named Paul Bistrick, who was born in Czechoslovakia. And so here on the 8th of May or 9th of May, he's in his homeland again, and he goes to visit his family's village. And while he's there, the townsfolk and his relatives all, you know, are very happy to see him. And so he fills up his Jeep with all sorts of booze, slivovitz and who knows, vodka, whatever else they had. And as he's going back to the 1st Division lines, the war's over and everybody's happy, they run into a group of Russian soldiers. And the Russians had not seen Americans before, and they didn't know who they were. They thought maybe they were Czech soldiers and they were giving them a hard time. And Bistrick did a song and dance to convince them that he was in fact American, and the Russians were so happy to see the Americans that they began kissing him, hugging him. They sat down, drank all of the booze that he had, and he said in his memoir that the Russian officer that was doing all the hugging and kissing gave him a German cigarette lighter. And he said, "Do you know how many German officers I had to kill to get this cigarette lighter? But I want you to have it." Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, part of the way the war, the end of the war, was celebrated there.
Yeah, individual soldiers often recall these momentous events in very peculiar and very particular ways.
Yeah. Now, you've done a lot of interviewing of 1st Division veterans of D-Day and beyond. How do they hold up? What... is there much esprit de corps which still holds them to memories of the 1st Division? For that matter, are many of them still involved in official events, in alumni organizations?
They are. A lot of them belong to the 1st Division Association. They come to the annual reunions. Many of them are over in France right now at the ceremonies that will be taking place this weekend.
I bet lots of them show up at your museum as
Indeed,
well.
Indeed, they do, in small family groups or in small groups. I'm actually next month hosting two reunions. One, a battalion of the 18th Infantry Regiment is coming on the 9th of July for a day visit. And then at the end of July, we're hosting the big annual reunion of the Society of the 1st Infantry Division, the main veterans group of the division, and we're expecting well over 1,000 of them to descend on Chicago at the end of July.
Now, these veterans of the 1st who were in the Big Red One during the war would have to be men in their late 70s on into their 80s.
Absolutely correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
Even beyond, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And some of the senior officers.
Some vigorous and some not.
Sure.
You asked about their esprit de corps. I think to a man, everyone that I talked to is immensely proud of his service with the division and in service of their country. They're certainly sad about the casualties, but very proud of what they did.
I just wonder if we'll hear from any of them this very night.
I certainly hope so.
We're pausing for some commercials. Then we will be going to the telephones. So the lines are open at this instant, and the number is, as ever, 591-7200. 591-7200. And we look forward to calls. You don't have to be a veteran of the Big Red One to call, but if you are such a veteran and were in the division during World War II, we would be more than delighted to hear from you. 591-7200, the lines are open and available to you. Also, if you're listening at some great distance, particularly if you're listening over the Internet and want to reach us via email, the email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200. We return and go to your calls and emails right after these words. And it's time to go to the telephones for your questions and or comments to Flint Whitlock and John Bochaw. Flint Whitlock is a military historian whose new book is The Fighting First, The Untold Story of the Big Red One on D-Day. And Colonel John Bochaw is the executive director of the 1st Division Museum at Cantini. Our phone number is 591-7200. You don't have to be a veteran of the Big Red One to give us a call. Any question you've got or anything you'd like to talk about in relation to the matters we've been discussing tonight, you are more than welcome. 591-7200. For a while, all the lines were filled, but now we've got a few available again, so if you're trying to reach us, make another quick try. And we'll go to the first caller. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I'm wondering, we had a family friend who was killed at Remagen, and if you could just maybe go into a little bit of detail. I don't really, you know, remember too much about him, but if you could maybe give us a little bit of background as to what exactly happened.
That's where the one bridge over the Rhine was not destroyed, isn't that right?
The Ludendorff Railroad Bridge across the Rhine River. It was heavily fortified. It was covered by artillery. Hitler demanded that it not be surrendered and that it be protected at great cost. As it turned out, it was just a stroke of good fortune that it was still standing at the time the 9th Armored Division forces moved into the area and discovered that it was still up. And, of course, here's where Yankee ingenuity and innovation takes hold. And a decision made to quickly cross the bridge, even though knowing that it was probably mined, in order to seize control of it. The Germans, of course, try mightily to knock it down with artillery and even with air. But we do get forces on the other side. I interviewed General Westmoreland a number of years ago, and he was a young colonel. He was the chief of staff of the 9th Infantry Division at the time, and he told me that he had gotten the word to quickly move down and take command of forces that were trying to converge on the bridge and get across and establish the bridgehead on the other side. He said he got to the bridge and some of the cross pieces and boards in the bridge, it was after all a railroad bridge, had been knocked out, and that he had his driver drive the Jeep across the bridge while he laid on the hood with a flashlight because they were losing light at the end of the day, and managed to get across to the other side. So there were great feats of ingenuity and seizing the initiative that was very important.
Yeah, also at Remagen was one of the places where the Germans used their jet aircraft, their ME-262s, to try and knock out the bridge, and it stayed more or less intact for a few days, and then it collapsed, and a number of engineers who were working to stabilize the bridge were killed when it collapsed, and so then they had to put pontoon bridges across the river and continue the march across the Rhine that way.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. 591-7200 is where you reach us. We'd be very pleased to hear from veterans, whether you're a veteran of the 1st Division or of any other outfit in the Great War. 591-7200, or for that matter, veterans of later wars, who've got comparable experiences. What are the similarities, what are the differences between Vietnam, where both of you guys fought, and World War II? 591-7200. In fact, I'll raise that question right now. Having raised it, I will press it upon you right now. What do you think was the difference in terms of the situations faced by the man on the ground, whether officer or enlisted man?
Well, I think, in my opinion, that it was more or less a static war on the part of the Americans and South Vietnamese, that we had the territory already. We were trying to hold it. We were trying to interdict the enemy from coming down. World War II, in most theaters, was a war of movement. You landed in one place, and you drove to your objective. It might be 100 miles away. It might be 300 miles away. Whatever it was, you were continually taking territory away from the enemy.
It occurs to me, then, that the Vietnam War, as you had to fight it, was rather like the situation that our forces face right now in Iraq.
That's right. They're fighting a static defensive war, and the enemy knows where they are, and they're taking pot shots at them, and it's not like we're trying to, you know, take out more of the territory, which we did when we made the initial landing last year and drove to Baghdad and then further north. We've already captured the whole city and now, or the whole country, and now we're trying to stop the insurgents.
In terms of basic troop leading, though, at the company and battalion level, many of the activities are exactly the same. You have the same leader soldier responsibilities that are working. Training is exceedingly important. intelligence is very important. So there are a lot of commonalities between Vietnam and what's happening today and what happened in World War II.
In Vietnam, you still had some senior officers who had been fully involved in World War II.
Oh, yes, indeed. I'll give you an example. The commander of the 1st Infantry Division in Vietnam, one of the six commanders, was Major General Bill Depew. And both his assistant commanders, Jim Hollingsworth, who lives in San Antonio right now, retired, was World War II veterans. Yeah. Hollingsworth was a tank battalion commander, and Depew was an infantry regimental commander.
Of course, you mentioned Westmoreland in World War II, and he then was, for the longest period, the commanding general in Vietnam, wasn't
he? Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And there's also a very tragic story that has to do with the 1st Division, that Terry Allen, who had been the 1st commander in North Africa and Sicily, after he was relieved of command, he went back to the States and then was put in command of another division, the 104th. But his son, Terry Allen Jr., became a battalion commander with the Big Red One in Vietnam, and he was killed in action in 1967. And I think that was a terrible event from which the elder Allen did not recover.
Yeah. 591-7200 is our number. We'll go back to the phones and right after some coming commercials. And there is room on the board. If you want to join us, move quickly and you will probably get through. Or somebody will certainly get through. 591-7200 for veterans, non-veterans, relatives of veterans of the Big Red One or of some other outfit in the vast American military establishment. We return after this. And in our discussion of the American 1st Division on D-Day in World War II, which comes to its 60th anniversary in just 2 days, we are joined by Flint Whitlock, who's done the basic book on all of that, The Fighting First, The Untold Story for the Big Red One on D-Day, and John Bochaw, U.S. Army retired, Colonel John Bochaw, who is Executive Director of the 1st Division Museum at Cantini. And, indeed, Flint will be out at Cantini this Sunday, is that right?
Yes, he will. On Sunday afternoon, he's going to speak at 2 p.m. at the 1st Division Museum on the estate, and also will be available to sign copies of his book, which can be purchased at the site.
And all who are listening are invited to attend?
We'd be happy to have you come.
No charge?
Well, there's a parking fee for your automobile, but other than that, it's...
That seems reasonable.
Yes.
591-7200 is the number. By the way, what's the number out at the museum?
At the museum, it's 260-8185. We'll get you directly into the office manager.
Good. And we go back to the phones on 591-7200. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I would like to ask the general if he remembers when the Big Red One patch became black.
Well, I suspected if you're talking about the subdued patch.
Patch
was...
I'm an ex-military wife, okay?
Oh, yes, of course. Well, we did have subdued patches in Vietnam, but generally the commanders and the men of the division chose...
No, I was at Fort Riley, and I had to rip off patches like crazy, you know, and sew on new ones, and it was unbelievable. My husband was in Vietnam.
Yes, go ahead.
I mean, well, he was wearing the red patch.
Oh, know. Yes, that's because it was by choice. I mean, most patches were subdued. First Division patches were made subdued, but the division chose not to wear them.
What does that mean, subdued?
That means a black number one on an olive green background.
Why?
Exactly. Because that's what we were told.
Simply to blend in with the uniform.
Fort Riley, that's exactly what they told you to do.
Well, apparently we have confirmation of that, ma'am, and we thank you for the call. Was the idea to reduce the visibility?
Yes, of course. Because, of course, that very high-colored patch on an otherwise camouflaged uniform stood out. But General Depew was very adamant about keeping the regular patch on the uniform. You know, some units at D-Day as well, particularly in the 16th Infantry, kept their patches on. There is a subdued patch now for the uniform in the Gulf region, which is a black normal on a patch. But again, General Batiste, I believe, has chosen to keep the regular patch.
Mm-hmm. And back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to see if you could fill in some details. A story my father told me, I believe he was in the second wave, I think he said, of D-Day. He was a medic and an ambulance driver. He told a story of how, told me how he would put some extensions onto the exhaust pipe, into the engine manifold, onto the ambulance, and then they drove them off of the troop carriers into the ocean, and they were submerged, and they just put the pedal to the metal and went up on the beach, and as soon as they got there, they jumped out of them, and then he talked about standing behind some sort of a concrete bulkhead or barrier for a couple days there under fire before they could get out. I was just trying to see if you could fill in any of the details where that might be or validate any of that.
What outfit was he in?
I really couldn't tell you.
So you don't know if he was in the 1st Division or not?
I really don't know, I'm sorry to say.
Well, then it would be very difficult to try and
fill
in those
gaps. If
he was
in the second wave during the assault on the 6th of June, he would have either been in the 16th Infantry Regiment or the 116th Infantry Regiment. Those were the two attacking regiments on Omaha Beach, unless he was at a different beach like Utah, in which case he might have been in the 4th Division, which was the assaulting division there.
I believe the 16th sounds familiar.
Yeah, 16th Regiment is one of the organic regiments of the 1st Infantry Division. He's probably talking about what we call a fording kit, which is a means to protect the engine when it's submerged. You don't want to do it for too long a time. And that water is pretty deep offshore at Omaha Beach, particularly when if you fall off the edge of a sandbar. There were, of course, aid stations set up on the beach and in protected areas immediately upon getting onto the sand. And I know, for example, up in the village of Colville-sur-Mer, which is close to the American Cemetery today, but at the time there were a number of the farmhouses that were used as aid stations in the vicinity up on the top.
And in my book, there's a photograph of a German bunker that is under new management. And you can see some GIs standing in the doorway, and there are maybe 20 or so stretchers that are leaned up against the concrete exterior wall of the bunker. And it is my supposition that they had turned this bunker into an aid station. So it's possible that your father was somewhere in that vicinity.
Colville-sur-Mer, you say?
That's in within the sector of Easy Red Beach, the landing beach, and Colville-sur-Mer is the major French village in that vicinity.
So so the idea of in that second wave, were they still under pretty significant fire as they landed on the beach?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the idea of actually staying behind that the bulkhead or some sort of a barrier there for a couple days, I could never quite figure out, you know, what that might have been like.
Well, you don't want your first line. Of course, the aid men themselves are out with the front line troops. They're going up and down the line, going to the various fighting positions and tending to the wounded and evacuating those that need to go back to the rear where they can get better medical care from a doctor. The idea, of course, is to protect the patients as much as possible. So the medics will be looking for covered and protected positions to establish the aid stations.
So we thank you for the call.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you, and we'll go directly to another on 591-7200. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Hello, this is Mike.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I worked for a fellow named Don Yap who was made the initial assault on Omaha Beach in the 1st Infantry, the Big Red One, and he shared with me that he was very upset with Eisenhower about putting him on the boats with the weather conditions the way they were, and he said that as they approached the beach they were taking tremendous mortar and machine gun fire, and the coxswain evidently was going to let them off early, and his friend Tara pointed his M1 at him and told him, you go in or you'll be the first one to get it. And they got in close to the beach, whatever that meant. But I still think they got let off in chest high water. But he later made it as far as Khan, I believe, and was hit in the leg by a sniper. A clip went off in his leg, and he was taken prisoner, but a doctor by the name of Dr. Fritz Kobel saved his life. A German medical physician. And he, in turn, later on, he became a very wealthy man. He went back to Germany, found this guy, took very good care of him, and ended up naming a very good racehorse after Dr. Fritz Kobel.
That's a great story.
Yeah, well, it was quite common in World War II for the Germans to take care of American wounded and for American medics and doctors to take care of German wounded. It wasn't quite the same against the Japanese, but there are a number of instances that are well documented where the enemy medical personnel take care of their foe. And you brought up about your father or this other gentleman talking about the his anger towards Eisenhower for having them go during the storm and the bad weather conditions. I think it's probably supposition on our part, but the bad weather also played a role in making the invasion a success, because the previous invasions that Eisenhower had led in North Africa and Sicily were done in good weather, and the Germans just didn't expect it to happen in the teeth of a storm, and it really caught them by surprise.
Our thanks to the caller, and we pause for a last quick round of messages and then directly back to more calls on 591-7200. If you want to reach us via email, that address is extension720@tribune.com. And with regard to our audio archive, about which you just heard a notice, we have just put up, in record speed, I would say, the program that we did a few nights ago commemorating the 80th anniversary of the first broadcast on WGN. My guests were Ward Qual, who ran the radio and television station for some 21 years, and our good buddy Roy Leonard, who broadcast here for some 31 years and retired only a few years ago. So if you want to hear clips from early broadcasts and a good deal about the history of WGN radio, go to our audio archive. You do that by going to WGNradio.com. Click on my name. That takes you to the sub-site for this radio program, and you have a number of choices. One is called Audio Archive. Click on that, and you're home. And you can hear that program again or hear it for the first time if you missed it. 591-7200 is the number, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Yes, I fought with the 45th Infantry Division, called Thunderbirds, from Anzio to almost the end of the war.
Oh, how good. How interesting.
And do you know what their original insignia was?
A swastika.
That is right.
Really?
Yes,
you
sir.
Mean before the Nazis adopted it?
Beg pardon?
That would have been before the Nazis adopted
the
swastika.
I told them, I said, you dummies, you took that off. We could have walked into their lines. I said, we're one of you.
Yeah, you might have been shot by your own people, though.
You
yeah.
know something that bugs me to the end that I cannot understand? When we hit the south of France, we walked in. I'm telling you, we walked in. Mm-hmm. Now, how come they couldn't have tried there before Normandy?
Well, then they would have had to get all the troops and supplies from England to the south of France.
Yeah, but then we had Sicily conquered.
Yeah, but they would have still had to transfer all of that equipment. I wrote a book about your division called The Rock of Anzio.
Right.
And it an incredible division, 550 days of combat.
511, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry, 511. And just an incredible story of what a group of National Guard soldiers mm-hmm. who started out doing this part time.
Quite a few were
accomplish.
Indians, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Now, where did you live? When did you get into the division?
I was Chicago. I was born and raised in Chicago.
Okay.
And I can tell you a little story too.
Go ahead.
My great nephew is a cub killer.
A cub killer.
Yes, sir. He's a baseball player called Jeremy Burnett.
Uh-oh.
That is my great nephew.
He plays for the Rockies.
Right.
Yeah, that's.
He says to me when I was in for the game, he says, Uncle Eddie, aren't you tired of buying hats?
But tell us that's a little great. Bit more about your war experience.
Well, I was wounded three times. I was wounded on Anzio the day that they pushed off for Rome on the 26th of May.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, and I was in the hospital, and the scuttlebutt on the beachhead, it was in March, that when we took Rome, we were going to pull back to Salerno and take amphibious training for the south of France.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it, because Axis Sally, she knew everything.
That's right. She told you more than you knew from your top brass.
And we even had, when we landed in the south of France, well, about a week after we landed, all our artillery and tanks were coming up on line with us, and we said, what's going on here? You guys usually don't come up with us. They said, the Germans are bringing horse-drawn artillery that they took out of the museums from World War I. And they fired on us, and then we threw everything we had at them, and when we went in, I'll tell you, whenever I see a horse, I cannot stomach it. Because those poor things tried to drag those wagons through the forest and everything, and...
That's right.
Do you get together with your old buddies these days anymore?
I do once in a while, but my wife passed away about a little over four years ago, and she was the one that pushed me all the time. She was in the Navy in World War II.
Really?
Which regiment were you with, or which unit?
179th L Company.
Okay, very good.
In fact, I met this guy in the doctor's office, the eye doctor in Elgin, and guess what? We were in the same company, everything at 179. We talk with each other quite often.
Uh-huh.
We were wounded on the 29th of March.
Hmm.
And he's from Elgin. His name is Arthur Rickloff.
You sound like you're still in very good health and very vigorous.
Well, I'm 81. No, I get a little arthritis.
That should be the worst of your
troubles. Otherwise, I'm high blood pressure.
Well, sir, thank you so much for calling.
Okay, and thank you for listening.
Delightful to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Good night for now. And let's go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I saw a documentary on the 507th Parachute Infantry Regiment, and it was very interesting. They parachuted with the 82nd and the 101st Airborne, according to the documentary, and they missed their drop zone by 20 miles.
Mm-hmm. That happened.
Often.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then in a very big battle in a town, I think it was Chauvigny, they were attacked, and then their wounded were massacred along with the doctor.
Hmm. Well, that was up in Belgium, wasn't it?
In France.
In France?
Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes as I was saying earlier, the enemy medics took care of the American wounded, and sometimes the soldiers didn't want to be burdened with American wounded and unfortunately shot them. And that's just one of those terrible things that happen in war. Not everybody plays by the rules.
It's been happening in war since the Peloponnesian War.
Well, maybe before.
Or before. And we go to this caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Colonel Vota, I just wanted to say that I've been going to Cantini Park since I was a young boy. I went with my grandfather, who is a World War II veteran, and I am currently in the service, and I just actually am on leave, and I went back today, and I just wanted to say that the park is beautiful, and for anyone who hasn't gone, it is an amazing tribute to the men who fought. I just wanted to say you're doing a marvelous job out there.
Well, that's a very welcome comment. I welcome it, and I haven't given you enough of a chance tonight to talk about the museum itself. John, I wish you would.
Well, we've been in our current location since 1992 in our magnificent museum and archive building. We have had over 1 million visitors as of several years ago in the new facility. We welcome over 100,000 visitors every year. I'd just like to take the opportunity before we go off the air to all our veterans that are listening to just simply say I thank you for your service. We'd love to see you at Cantini, and come on out and see us.
And Sarah, thank you for the call.
Thank you. God bless.
Good night for now. We've only got a minute or two left. You turned military historian after a brief hitch of your own. You were 5 years or so in the Army.
Right, right.
You retired as captain.
That's right.
But you spent a good deal of that time in Vietnam.
Well, only a year of it.
That would have been enough, I imagine.
Yeah. And I think back on the soldiers of World War II, that they didn't have a duration of time. It was for the duration of the war. Mm. There were no assurances that they were going to go home in a year. They went home after the war was over, or when they got too seriously wounded to serve, or you know, bless them, were killed in action. And so they had an entirely different mindset than those of us who were in Vietnam.
What do you both hear from people in the division in Iraq these
days?
Well,
we're in constant contact with them. We publish their newsletter at the museum. And so in that process, we get a lot of feedback from the division and from soldiers.
What are they saying?
I think they're saying, I don't know what that was.
Sounded like a bomb for a
moment. I think they're imbued with their mission. They understand why they're there. They understand that a whole generation of Iraqis depend on us doing the job as well as we can. They're very focused.
Who's commanding, and what's the structure right now?
The commander of the 1st Division is Major General John R. Batiste. He has a traditional structure of colonels who command brigades, and colonel commanding the artillery brigade, and then a whole structure down below that, battalions commanded by lieutenant colonels, and on down, companies commanded by captains.
You know, lots of Americans enjoy reading about military life and about particular battles or about wars or about divisions, as we can now do with this fine book by Flint Whitlock. But I don't think they fully understand the degree to which there are probably hundreds, certainly hundreds, possibly thousands of devoted military historians working in the world.
Well, that's true. Everybody has their little niche of interest, and they pursue it, get into some very arcane material in dusty archives, and just come up with gems. It's almost like mining for diamonds. And I include myself in that. They find little bits of history that have been forgotten and laid aside, and we now bring them out for the enjoyment and enlightenment of the public.
What's the greatest discovery you made in the doing of this book, a particular fact or particular incident? And I only got half a minute to ask that of you.
Not enough time to tell you, but it was to me, the fact that these soldiers did not tell their families these stories, because they went off to war to protect their country and protect their families, and so they could not come back and tell them all the things they saw and did. It was too horrible.
And that may even still be the case for those who survive.
I think so, definitely.
Fascinating. Our guests tonight have been Colonel John Votaw, Executive Director of the 1st Division Museum at Cantini, and Flint Whitlock, from whose book we've been drawing tonight. That excellent book is titled The Fighting First, The Untold Story of the Big Red One on D-Day, and it is published by Westview. And a few quick words about programs to come. We'll be here by tape Monday and Tuesday after ball games, and we'll be back in full force for a full two-hour program on Wednesday as we look at the presidential campaign with John McIntyre of RealClearPolitics.com, Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, Perry Arnold, a political scientist at Notre Dame University. Our thanks again to our two guests. Thanks to all for listening, and a cordial good night.